Welcome to Knot Work Myth and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination and our timeless connection to the land itself. Season 7, Episode 11, May the Roads Rise to Meet You, Following Macha's Trail. Welcome back to Knot Work Myth and Storytelling. I'm your host, Marisa Gowdy, and this is the fifth in our Turas series, our journey across the other world that always takes us deeper into relationship with this world. You'll know this one. May the roads rise to meet you. May the wind always be at your back. May the rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. When, as an American teenager, I heard what was generally known as the Irish blessing, I felt as if I had been initiated into some sort of spiritual wisdom tradition. I mean, I was at some level, but I was also looking at a framed bit of tourist paraphernalia up on someone's wall. I knew that, of course. I was a girl who strove to appear very deep, yearning to seem like I was someone who understood every Tori Amos lyric, even though, to be honest, I was much more of a Sarah McLachlan girl. But still, there was something about the cadence of those words that conjured the ancestors walking a long but not impossible road, being kissed by gentle weather, and always feeling sure there would be a good home to return to. It was nostalgia for a world that had never been, for a place I had never known. In other words, it was just more material for my myth-starved mouth. It would be the foundation of everything I'm doing 30 years later. As a teen, I ached so completely for magic, for the ancient, for the other world. You might say that I haven't changed that much. But since I couldn't just step through a portal into the Celtic twilight, then I'd take anything that was just a little bit mystical, a little bit older, a little bit more other than that boring nouveau American childhood I'd been given. So this particular episode of the Turas series draws on that decades-old yearning. This time, as part of our journey across the other world, over our imagined version of Tir na mBan, the land of women, we're taking to the road. We'll begin with the story of Macha, a goddess, a fairy woman, a banshee, who comes from the other world and spends some time on the island of Ireland. I imagine this story as one of walking and running different types of roads. I imagine it as a story of choice and the absence of choice. I imagine this story braiding with all those we've told so far and covering new territory all at the same time. A woman emerges from her home in the other world. Some say she was born from the womb of a mountain. Others say she came from a perfect island across the sea. She has the tang of salt to her, I think. Let's imagine she came from the distant western lands scattered across the wide, wide ocean. Let's say she caught a ride with Mananon, the god of the sea. She held tight to his arm as they raced across the watery plains in a chariot pulled by a great team of horses, all made of frothing waves and foam. Now, the moment she reached the shoreline, she began walking, walking, walking. She didn't need a road, not when she had a stride this purposeful and undeterred. In all the lifetimes since this story first unfolded, she never did tell a soul why she set out on this journey, this Turas across the island of Ireland. She was simply a woman, a fairy woman, on a mission, and where she was going, she didn't need roads. She could leap a river or vault over a mountain peak as easily as she could stroll on the strand on a sunny day. And so, over many days and nights, and also in no time at all, she made her way from the western shore to a strong farmer's lands in the north. Once he'd been a strong farmer. Now, the skinny cattle lowed mournfully in the pastures. The fields around the house lay fallow. The thin wisp of smoke that spiraled from the rooftop, it looked paltry and grim. Now, a woman from the other world, she shook the dust from her traveling cape and knocked the mud of the road from her fine boots, and she stepped inside, without so much as a knock or a hello the house. She walked straight to the fire and set to building it anew. Her sunshine ginger hair shone like a halo beside the cheerful blaze. And that's how the man of the house, Cruin MacAgnamon, found her. "Oh, good," she said. "We needed more firewood." He set the logs beside her, still dumbfounded at this creature who had decided to light up his gloom-drenched home with her presence. "Now," she said, "I'll be able to make the bread." From her satchel, she pulled a small bag of fine milled flour, and she got to work without another word. In her year in that house, this bag of flour would always be full, and their stomachs always would be too. Eventually, Cruin found his tongue and began to ask what it was she was doing there in his home. But she simply raised a single brow and returned to her kneading. He didn't press her. This wasn't the sort of world where you spoke of private property or the crime of entering uninvited. Instead, this was a society that prided itself on hospitality and thrived upon mystery. In her presence, the fog that had surrounded Cruin finally lifted. The very blood in his veins had gone cold when his wife and child had died on the same dark night 3 winters before. But now, on this day, he found his way back to life, simply and sweetly. He gathered eggs from the hens who had bothered to stay with him during his long malaise. He aired the house and took it upon himself to tidy up the nasty bits that had gathered in the shadows. When the sun set on this long day, the visitor curled up beside Cruin on his sleeping couch. They'd barely exchanged a word in their long hours together, but they found other ways to communicate till they heard the earliest birds of dawn. Now, as you might have gathered from the first part of this story, this woman was made for movement. After they'd shared a full breakfast, she told him it was time to walk his lands so she could get a sense of the place. If Cruin thought this was rather a strange request, he didn't say anything. What could be stranger than the events of the day before, after all? They walked the perimeter, taking in the swells and valleys of the earth, witnessing the hush of the deep forest that marked its edges. They cut across the heart of the territory, following the stream that once had flowed with sweet fresh water, but, like its master, had grown slow and dark in recent years. As they walked past, Cruin thought he heard the waters gather up and begin to babble again. They visited the herds, and Cruin swore he saw a bit of flesh return to their sad flanks. They passed the thickets that once were heavy with berries and now grew only thorns, and by the time they reached the end, Cruin saw fat blackberries resting on the branches. Together, they climbed the highest hill, and they surveyed Cruin's land, and beyond that, the king's holdings that stretched to the furthest horizon. She turned to him. "You may call me Maka. I was called to this land. It is you I call to my side. I will stand with you and lie with you and help you restore these hills and waters and herds." With that, she took off and ran thrice around the boundaries of the land, following the direction of the sun, and so she set the spell into motion. And so Maka stayed with Cruin. She became his wife. She became the mistress of the house. She became the guardian of the hills and the herds. Everything she touched flourished, including Cruin. Soon her own belly swelled with new life, but the pregnancy only seemed to increase her energy and power. Alas, as happy as Cruin was, he was not a man easily satisfied. He needed just a little bit more. He needed to walk amongst his peers and his betters and the lowly rabble who would envy him his good fortune. He declared he would go to King Conchifer's great fair. It was important to offer his thanks to the gods and offer homage to the High King around the great festival fire, he said. After a year such as this, he had so much to be thankful for, and gratitude is sweetest when shared. Now, the outside world of men, of cattle ranchers and kings and all the types who weave between them, they'd never played a part in their marriage. But Macha didn't seem to mind Cruin's decision. She voiced her only concern: do not break your vow. On that first dawn together, when they'd stood upon the hill, she'd made her promise to him, and she'd asked for a promise in return. "Say nothing of me. Tell no one I have come to live with you and keep your house and be your wife. Say nothing of the miracles that will happen here." Without a trace of reservation, he'd sworn he would never breathe a word of Macha to another human soul, though he may have taken a few of the cows in confidence so they could, together, marvel at their collective good fortune. Her hair, her hips, her lips, her eyes, her soft, strong hands, oh, and the sure majesty of her stride. It was an easy promise to make when Cruin hadn't seen another human soul in a year, but it would be harder when he found himself back in the company of men. Maka kissed Kruin farewell, and he mounted his favorite horse, his only horse, and set off to the festival. He followed a road that had begun to recede back into grass and stone. It had been 3 long years since he had ridden out where any riders had come to call, but still, he was a man who had a cellular memory of being amongst men. This road remembered what it was to be traveled. He found his way, and he found his swagger. There were merchants and peddlers, music and beer. So much beer. But Kruin did what he could to keep his head. He caught himself about to speak his brilliant wife's name. He stopped himself before he demanded that fellows raise a glass to him and his new growing family. He held his tongue well enough until the final morning, when he stood just a few yards from the king himself. Now, the king fancied himself a man of the people, but he also needed to prove that he was a cut above the rest. He ran his great black horses in great concentric circles around the sacred hill that stood at the heart of his kingdom. Conchifer was mightily entertained as the people and the sheep scattered, terrified of those churning hooves and bared teeth. This king was a lot. After 3 solid days of fermented celebration, Kruin had lost a bit of that humble gratitude that had drawn him to the festival fires. He offered no more respect to the king than was his due, and perhaps a little less than that. With a slur in his voice that would transform even the handsomest of men into a beast, he called out, "Hey, Conchifer, my wife can outrun those pieces of horseflesh. She can outrun them and break nary a sweat." Funny how a crowded field full of screaming humans and animals can hush at just the right or just the wrong moment. The king's head snapped round and his eyes locked on the staggering, swaggering cattle rancher. After a whole series of "how dare yous" and a whole volley of "who speaks such to the king," they got down to the question that never should have been asked. "Who is this wife of yours and what makes her so fast?" And poor Kruin, who really had deserved his year of happiness, at least until he betrayed it all in this moment of indiscretion, he suddenly collapsed to the ground. It all came out. His wife went by the name of Macha, and she had come from the west, perhaps from below or beyond the waves, and she shone with the light of the sun in every mood and season. If he mentioned that she was pregnant and due any day, no one listened. Conchifer and his troops had no interest in the pretty poetry of this description or the needs of a woman doing womanish things. They simply wanted to see the race. Kruin was held there at the fairgrounds, and the king's guard raced their own horses to the farm in the mountains. Maka could hear the pounding of those strange hooves, and she could interpret their story. Betrayal, doom, desolation. The end of their perfect year was etched into the earth with every hoofbeat. Perhaps she could have had the power to repel the invaders. She did not use it. The king's men did not bat an eye when they saw her pregnant body. They simply forced her upon the spare horse they'd brought from the king's stables and made her ride hard into the valley. The white mare she rode down the king's damnable road was hemmed in all sides by great dark geldings. The king awaited them at the base of the royal hill, the great temple looming above him. But no one spared a glance for Conchifer once Macha entered the scene. They say she was fierce for glory. Some thought it was the bloom of impending motherhood. Others thought it merely the exertion of the ride. All too few knew that it was the glow of the other world on her cheeks and in her eyes. She did not notice Kruin, but nor did she look for him. That chapter had closed, and she would barely have recognized him in a crowd, even though his face had been her most beloved for nearly a year. Maka called out to the king and those assembled around him, "Conchifer, have mercy as you would hope that any bully, bandit, or king would have upon your own mother. I'm about to give birth and cannot race your horses with a belly so heavy with child." So then what? What happens next? Does Maka run? Does Maka win? Well, you'll hear the conclusion of the story and a deeper exploration of the mythic resonance of the roads and trails and paths in this world and in the other world in the full episode that's available now at the Mythworkers Hearth. The complete Torres episodes are available to my paid Substack subscribers now. To subscribe to hear all the stories, as well as receive special invitations to our Mythworkers Hearth gatherings held every month or so, please visit mythworkers.com. Thank you for tuning in to Knot Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. Want more knot work in your life? Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, The Mythworker's Hearth, over on Substack. As a paid subscriber, you'll have access to the special new podcast series called Turas, which takes you even deeper into mythology, landscape, and the creative journey. And yes, that's a new name. You may know my newsletter as Myth is Medicine. It's now The Mythworker's Hearth. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. You can find out more about my writing, my book, The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, our online writing communities, including the Author's Knot, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach over at my website, marisagowdy.com. Music on the show is by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy, a Celtic fiddle and multi-instrumental duo based on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Find out about their music and shows at billyandbeth.com. My own work is inspired and sourced through a connection to my Irish ancestors. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Lenape, whose name means original people.